This is Doreen Salcy, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. Welcome to Stories for the Nighttime and Some for the Day. The Town Dog. The town dog could tell what day it was. It bothered us that this dog was so smart. Besides knowing what day it was, he knew that there was a fine line between the dignity of a beggar and the repugnance of a parasite. Late Sunday afternoons, he would show up across the street at Tia Chata's and sleep on the cool concrete porch. He would spend the night there, and morning would find him still lying on his side, breathing regularly with not a care in the world. Never would the mongrel move out of the way for the poor woman. It was she who had to respect him and his territory. He'd stretch out, yawn, scratch off some fleas, and then wait for Tia Chata to feed him the scraps left over from breakfast. He'd watch through the window at Tia Chata getting ready for early mass. When she came out, he would escort her to the steps of the church, as though she could never find her own way without him. He'd wait patiently outside for mass to be over. When the women came out, he would sit up attentively, looking for Tia Chata. He would then spot her, walk over, and lick her hand. He would accompany her back home and spend the rest of the day sleeping or patrolling her yard, chasing away any other dogs who might be a threat to Tia Chata's chickens. Sometime during the day, he never failed to prance around as though he owned the yard and was earning his keep. He paid particular attention not to offend Tia Chata by disturbing the canaries. He walked around the canaries on tiptoes. Monday evenings, he would trot off across the street to stay with Father Savala on the rectory steps. Father Savala didn't mind him. He stepped over the lying dog as he went in or out of the rectory. On Tuesday morning, the dog was fed breakfast leftovers by Otilia, who cooked for Father Savala. At the sound of the bells, he would walk over to the front of the church and go through the ritual of smelling everyone who entered church for early mass. Tuesday was more of a day of leisure for him than for Father Savala. He would sleep all day, opening an eye once in a while, not having to protect any hens, letting out a bored sigh as though he were doing the priest a favor by being there. Then, when he had the priest's attention, he would take on a sad countenance, as if to tell him how tiresome this holy life could be. Tuesday night, you could find him in the center of town, at the intersection where the drugstore, the post office, the old movie house, and the barber shop were located. He'd sleep there, moving alternatively from one place to the other, depending on how much the noise in any particular place interfered with his trying to fall asleep. In the morning, he would walk by the San Diego Cafe and get a bite to eat at the rear, where the cook had thrown out some old food. He would spend Wednesday in town, going from store to store, acting like he was going to buy something, and then backing off as though someone had insulted him and made him change his mind. Wednesday night, he would spend at the top of the courthouse steps. In the mornings, he would follow the county employees around the hallways. Sometimes he would take in a trial or two, if he had the time, and if he felt the trial was well attended. He loved a grand entrance into the courtroom. He reserved some time to visit the prisoners in jail, licking their hands and trying to cheer them up. It was up to the people there to feed him whatever they had left of their lunch. Usually, the jailer had some food that the prisoners wouldn't eat, and the dog got to eat it. Naturally, he was sure to be at the jail at mealtimes. Thursdays, he would come to sleep with us. He enjoyed spring and summer, the hottest time of the year in South Texas, since we often slept outside on the porch and he could sleep among us, spreading his fleas around. Bright and early on Friday mornings, he would start to bark to get us out of bed. He was ready to play. He ate whatever we could give him, but it didn't matter to him. He wanted to play. He'd run to the creek with us and spend most of the time in the cave. Sometimes he would be allowed to play baseball with us. He was perfect at chasing down the batter. Friday, early in the evening, he would leave for the COD bar downtown. He knew where the action was on that night. He'd sleep on the low steps watching all the men go in and out. He'd spend Saturday at the bar, looking around, getting up once in a while when someone would call him, taking a bite of food here and there. Saturday night, he would disappear and we would not see him again until Sunday night, when he would show up at Dia Chatas. He knew Sunday was a day of rest. We followed him and found out where he lived when he wasn't in town. He lived at the creek in the center of a heavily wooded area. He had a hole dug out in a clearing from which he could see anyone approaching. This is where he stayed on Saturday night and most of the day Sunday, resting. From his home atop the creek bank, he could see the little town, see all the goings-on Saturday night and most of Sunday. He would not deviate from this routine. Somehow he knew what day of the week it was from his observations of the townspeople. We decided to trick the dog, to see if we could confuse him. On a Friday morning, when he was outside barking for us to come out and play, we ran to the creek with him and took him inside our cave. Juan had brought food for him, and Matias brought a pail for water. We left food and water for him and left the cave. He spent all of Friday and Saturday in the cave. We could hear him snoring inside. Nothing seemed to bother him. We fed him and gave him water again, and late Sunday evening we turned him loose. We were watching him to see what he would do. He came out of the cave and acted disoriented for a while. He stretched out his limbs and looked to the town spread out below him. His little eyes focused on several points. We ran back and he ran back with us. We thought we had him fooled. He was going back home with us. We were laughing at him and he seemed to enjoy the run, having been cooped up for such a long time. We were egging him on to follow us. He was in the middle of the pack, running, his tongue hanging out. At the corner, before we got home, he began to veer to his left. We tried to get him to go straight ahead with us, but he was determined, and the lure of his senses too strong. He pushed his way out of the pack and headed straight for Tia Chatas, with us running after him. At the Achatas, he barked for her just to tell her he had arrived and would be needing something to eat in the morning. He knew it was Sunday evening and that the Achata would be waiting for him. Later on, with nothing else to do, we tried to confuse him again and again. On the day he spent with us, we acted as if it were Sunday and we were going to Mass. The next week, when he came by, we hid from him and watched his reaction. He slept on our porch as though he knew exactly where we were. Nothing worked. There was something he was aware of that we could not discover. Some people said the dog had magical powers and that he could cast the evil eye. But my grandfather said it wasn't true. No man, except man, has ever tried to hurt another with witchcraft. All dogs are very observant, my grandfather said. Why, a dog is smart enough to create his own fleas. Why would a dog want to have fleas? We asked. To keep himself occupied, my grandfather replied. My grandfather was right. We knew the dog was very observant. We could see him looking about the town from his vantage point. It was a combination of the town's activities, its routines, that led the dog along certain paths, made him come to the right conclusions. It may have been the ringing of the bell, the wailing of the town siren, the music coming from the center of town, the visions of the old women dressed in black and weaving their way to the rosary at different times during the week, the daily movements of Father Zavala, of the town mayor, the tradesmen in town, the different smells coming from the kitchens, the variations in the sounds of conversations, the activity at the courthouse, the gathering of people on Saturdays at the barbershop, Chata's pounding on the piano. Whatever it was, the dog had it figured out even if we never could. As for us children, we had to finally admit that lowly mongrel was the one creature in town we could never fool. Reviving a Hen. From the book I Can Hear the Cowbells Ring by Leonel G. Garcia. In those days, there was an abundance of birds in South Texas. We knew the Spanish names for the birds, but little else. And even at that, we were not very good, often not knowing which bird was which, arguing among ourselves about the names of the birds. My Uncle Merced, the lunatic, knew more about birds than anyone else in town. He knew how they flew, where they nested, and how they built their nests. He could even identify the different birds' nests. There was the killdeer, which we trapped with a wooden box and corn for bait. We called him the tildillo, the Latinized version of the English name. Although we seldom caught the bird, when we did, we didn't know what to do with him. He was horrible to eat. He tasted like Epsom salts. The crow was fascinating. We would follow the crow for hours, watching him push everybody around, stealing food. The whippoorwill was noisy. The wren was the most prolific, but horrible to eat also. The cardinal was the most beautiful. The scissor tail was the oddest in the way it flew. We would go to the creek to spend whole days running after birds, trying to shoot them down with our little slingshots made from forks of mesquite and strips of old inner tubes. For a pouch, we cut the tongue off an old shoe and tied it between the ends of the two rubber strips. In the pouch, we would place the stone used as ammunition. One time, we cut the tongues off an old pair of shoes we found in the shed, and then found out they belonged to an uncle who was storing his clothes there. He had a fit when he discovered the shoes without tongues. No one admitted anything, although my grandmother conducted a mini investigation. My Uncle Merced had told us that to revive a bird, all you had to do was raise the tail feathers, place your lips about an inch from the hole, and blow air up its rear end. As soon as someone was lucky enough to stun a bird, we would run to it, pick it up, and begin to blow into its rear end. But it never seemed to work for us. At least once, we had prayed that it would work. We'd been messing around in the yard, throwing things at each other, playing at first, but then getting more serious after Matias hit Cota very hard with a rock. Then we started throwing rocks at Matias. Matias was picking up the rocks thrown at him and throwing them back at us. He threw a rock and hit my sister Sylvia, and she began to cry. The juices of anger were stirred when the defenseless Sylvia was hurt. We took off after Matias, and Matias took off running. He ran across the street into Tia Chata's yard. Tia Chata was a very large, fat lady. Her arms were almost as thick as my waist was then. She was beautiful and kind and always in wonderful spirits. When she played the piano, her style was to attack the instrument, making it almost bounce off the floor. All she knew were marches and waltzes, and she played both with equal passion. You could swear the house was shaking when she sat at the piano every afternoon. She lived across the street from us and almost directly across from the rectory. Tia Chata's yard was huge, a quarter of a city block. Her house was big by our standards and made of formed limestone blocks called sillares. Each block was about a cubic yard in size. The blocks had been raised and put in place using mules that pulled ropes over winches and pulleys. It was a common form of construction in the days of the early settlers. The roof was made of long, wide tin strips. Her house was always cool in the summer, its windows large, reaching almost from floor to ceiling, all around the concrete porch which surrounded the house. Tia Chata was a spinster who had raised her dead sister's four sons from very early childhood and had done a splendid job of raising them, too. She was one of those ladies who went to the rosary every night, along with my grandmother. Her hobbies were raising canaries, which she kept caged inside double-screened windows. Passing by her house, one could hear them singing all day long, Chata singing along with them. In the afternoon, when Chata sat at the piano to play, the canaries would hover against the limestone walls, wondering about the significance of the torrent of noise. At night, she would cover her precious canaries with sheets to allow them to sleep. Her other hobby was raising chickens for eggs for the family. She worked out in the yard most of the day, doing something or other. She was never idle. She was also always studying something new. She spoke no English at all, but very proper Spanish. She had no qualms about correcting what we said, making sure we used the right word. Once, she asked me how old I was, and when I told her, she calculated that it was all right for me to do her the favor of climbing up the windmill to untangle the cable on the brake. I climbed nervously. It was a beautiful sight from the top of the windmill. Tia Chata cautioned me to be careful. She was afraid I would fall. Juan, Matias, Cota, Maggie, Francis, Richard, and Sylvia were egging me on. If you should hurt yourself, I would never forgive myself, she yelled up to me, not to mention what your grandmother and mother would do to me. And then she laughed out loud. I could see the whole town. Across the street, I could see Walter Meek's windmill at my same level. Before coming down, I stood up and beat my chest and screamed like Tarzan. By the time I reached the ground, Tia Chata was laughing her jolly laugh. She put her hand inside her apron pocket and pulled out a coin and gave it to me. A nickel. Tia Chata's favorite hen and her biggest layer was one she called La Blanca. This hen laid at least one egg a day, sometimes two. Tia Chata loved her, treated her with the same affection she had for everyone else. She spoke to her in the yard as if she were a person. She told the hen her problems, her joys. Every morning the routine was the same. Tia Chata would come out before breakfast with a pail of chicken feed, call up her chickens, La Blanca proudly waggling ahead of the pack, knowing she was the preferred one. Tia Chata would talk to all of them, but La Blanca got the most attention. Tia Chata scattered more feed in front of her than anyone else. Tia Chata had her for several years now, and she would often tell the story of how she had raised her from an egg. Their bond was such that if Tia Chata was in the yard, the hen was not far behind. Every morning, Tia Chata would gather the eggs from the little hen house in which she locked her chickens at night. This morning, Tia Chata was outside hand-watering her bougainvilleas. She turned around to see what we were doing. Matias had run halfway through the yard and we were getting closer. Matias had made a turn to evade us and was running toward the windmill. He managed to dodge us while still going for the windmill. He went around the windmill and was running back from where he came. We ran around the windmill after him. Finally, he ran toward Chata, hoping this would make us stop. We saw the look of confusion on Tia Chata's face. She did not know what to make of all this running and screaming. I was behind the pack. I knew I could never catch Matias, so I picked up a rock and threw it at him as hard as I could. I had no hope of reaching him with a rock. The rock took off from my hand and sailed more to the right than I had meant. I watched it go off in that direction. The rest of the pack stopped when they saw the rock overhead. Matias stopped to see why we weren't chasing him. The rock continued on its way, reached the top of its arc, and then began to descend. Slowly, painfully, I watched along with the others as the rock came down toward La Blanca, who was close by Tia Chata, busily pecking away at some bug on the ground. The rock could not have been thrown more perfectly if one had wanted to kill the most favored chicken. But then, as the rock glided down, I thought that even if I did hit the chicken, I would not hurt it in any way. I was too little to cause much damage. But Providence being what it is, the rock hit the chicken on the only place where it could kill it. The rock hit La Blanca on the top of the head. What could one say to Tia Chata to soothe her feelings? She had been following the rock as we all had. When it hit the chicken on top of the hen flopped over, dead. Tia Chata let out a scream. The hen experienced several muscular twitches and a few gapes of the beak. Death was instantaneous. By the time Tia Chata rushed the few steps to reach La Blanca, the chicken was dead. Quickly we ran to La Blanca. Tia Chata had her in her arms, crying. Juan took her away from Tia Chata. He began to blow air up its rear end. Then Cota tried it. Francis kept on. Then Maggie. Matias had returned and tried it also. At last, it came my turn. Cota was holding the limp chicken, the rear end in my face, looking at me like she knew I was in a lot of trouble. I had to revive the hen. Frantically, I held the tail up and blew. I'm sure my face was red with fear, embarrassment, hyperventilation. I was lightheaded. I staggered around. Tia Chata finally could not take any more of this. She began to laugh. She could not figure out what it was we were doing. She had never seen this form of resuscitation before. She went into her house, and everything was quiet for a while. We sat on the porch, passing the dead chicken around, each one trying to revive her. Then we heard Tia Chata begin to pound on the piano. First a march, Zacatecas. Then a very sad waltz, Morir Soñando. We persisted in trying to revive the chicken, but our efforts had become half-hearted. The canaries were screaming. When she came out, we could tell she had been crying. I told her how sorry I was, and she gave me a smile, reached out for me, and engulfed me with her enormous body in a hug. "I know you didn't mean it," she said. "It was an accident. Then she asked the inevitable question, "Who in the world taught you children to blow into a chicken's rear end to revive it?" "Merci," we all said. She had the courtesy not to laugh again. She asked us if we would bury La Blanca for her. She did not want to eat her. She went in to keep on with the piano. We didn't bury the hen. We dug a hole behind Tia Chata's house, threw a rock in, and covered it. Juan stuck the chicken inside his pants, and we took it to the creek. There, we plucked it and started a fire and roasted it. But La Blanca was so hard and tough, we couldn't cut her up to eat. We tried boiling her. After an hour, we couldn't eat her. We boiled her some more. In all, we must have boiled the hen 2 or 3 hours. It took that long before we could eat her. And then she was not so tender. She was the toughest bird we ever ate, and by now she tasted like killdeer. Chata did tell my grandmother and mother, and we were forbidden to ever go into her yard again. But Chata intervened. She forgave us and told my grandmother and mother that we could play in her yard. We were allowed to play in Tia Chata's yard on one condition. "If you kill another one of her hens, then I'm going to whip all of you," my grandmother warned us. There was another side to Tia Chata we had never known, a playful, sadistic side. Although she forgave us, she never quite let us forget we had killed her dear hen. When she called me to climb up the windmill to fix the cable on the brake, she would remind me of what I'd done. Then she would reach inside her apron pocket and give me a nickel. And afterwards, when we would go past her house and she would be out in the yard or cooling herself off, seated on the porch, she would say, "There go the beautiful children who kill my beloved La Blanca. How I miss her." She would sigh. Her guilt-inducing sadness was temporary, though. Soon she would give out her robust laugh and then ask, "Which of you is the most beautiful?" "Matias," Juan would answer. "Juan," Matias would answer. "Gota," Maggie would answer. "Maggie," Francis would answer. And so on. Then she would fan her face red from the heat of the day and tilt her head to listen to her beloved canaries. "I'll never have a hen like her again," she would say. "Never. Not even if I live to be 100 years old. At the end of the block, we could hear the thunder coming from her house, the introduction to the march Zacatecas. We were never able to steal enough hens from the creek to replace La Blanca. Tia Chata refused them all. She knew we had stolen them, and she was much too honest to accept them. And besides, her hen was irreplaceable. She died many years later, still asking my mother how the hen killer was doing. This is Doreen Salcy, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. Of Sows and Hemorrhoids. My grandfather had farmed in the north part of the county, and even farther to the west toward Freer, almost to a ranch called Siete Hermanas. He farmed mostly grain sorghum. Hygeia, we called it then, not realizing that that was the name of the company which produced the seed. He farmed a few acres of watermelons. We would eat watermelons at night, still hot from the day-long sun, ripping the heart of the fruit out with our bare hands. He raised peanuts one year, and since we had never before seen peanuts grow, he took us to the field one day and told us to pick all the peanuts we could find, gather them, and bring them in to check our crop. We never found any, not knowing that they grew underground, And he laughed so much at us and told the story on us afterward for many years, until he died of a heart attack at the meat market. In spite of my grandmother's worrying about him, he agreed with farming, sharecropping like he always did with Mr. Gallagher, an old man from Alice who had a few acres to the south of San Diego. Mr. Gallagher, as he insisted that we call him, didn't farm. He enjoyed raising the big fat hogs that were so popular in those days. Hogs so big it took 3 men with rifles to kill one. One each to shoot at the side of the skull, and one to shoot at the forehead at the point in the cross where the 2 lines from the eyes to the opposite ear bisect. Hogs that must have weighed 700 pounds, that were bigger than 4 men, that lay about in the mud eating leftover trash Mr. Gallagher fed them. Of all his pigs, Mr. Gallagher loved his sows the most. He loved them more than his family. One time, he tried to kill a boar by himself when we weren't around so he wouldn't have to share, and instead of killing the hog, he almost killed himself. He took out his .22 rifle and tried to shoot the animal, and the boar went crazy, angry at someone who would be pestering him with little bits of pain. It attacked Mr. Gallagher, pinned him face down in the mud, and then sat on him. If we hadn't come by when we heard the squeals of disgust from the hog, Mr. Gallagher would have died in the pig pen. So he learned his lesson, and he would ask us to help him, something we didn't like doing since we were sharecropping. And we knew Mr. Gallagher was going to bring his son Hebert with him from Alice, and that we were only going to get a few pounds of pork skin. "You Mexicans don't like meat anyway," he would say. "You'd be surprised," my grandfather would answer. Mr. Gallagher liked to speak Spanish to us, although we all understood English, especially my grandfather, who had a good vocabulary. But Mr. Gallagher enjoyed speaking in Spanish, remembering, I'm sure, the old days, when, as he liked to brag, he had 10 Mexicans working for him on a ranch in Beeville. His problem was that, because Spanish is a language which depends so much on gender, when someone who only has a casual knowledge of the language speaks it and confuses the gender, it not only irritates the ear, but it also offends the soul. And not wanting to correct the old man constantly, we would just walk away from him and nod our heads. We would leave him standing there wondering if we had understood or not. "Comprenda?" he would ask, using the wrong word ending again as we walked away. He never realized that it was easier for us to communicate in English than it was for him to speak Spanish. But I suppose he felt superior to us using Spanish. That would make him completely bilingual, smarter. We were not supposed to know English. Mr. Gallagher came over one day when we were out in the field, and he stopped my grandfather in his tractor and informed us he had just sold the old boar, the one that had almost killed him. We looked over to the pig pen in the distance and saw the men running out in the field, chasing the old boar, trying to catch him and load him. By the time we left for home, when we went by the pig pen, all we saw were the sows and the damage the boar had done to the pig pen. We could see where the big hog had ripped off boards and had escaped. There were tire marks on the ground, where the driver had spun his wheels, dragging the boar across the yard from the little house by the fence. They were forced to load up the boar in the open field. We could see where the loading door from the trailer had dragged across several rows. Mr. Gallagher didn't show up in the morning of the next day, and my grandfather worried about him. We were sitting under a mesquite, eating our lunch when we saw the dust from the old pickup coming up the road. "There he is," my grandfather said. "I wonder why he's so late." We waited in the shade as Mr. Gallagher drove over to where we hid from the noonday sun. He drove under the shade, got off, and greeted us all. "What happened to you?" my grandfather asked him. Mr. Gallagher looked down, spat, and said, "It's my brother in San Antonio. He's had a heart attack. I gotta go see him. Muy mala." "Malo," Juan corrected him. "Is he dying?" my grandfather asked, ignoring Juan. "No," Mr. Gallagher replied. "He's doing fine, but I have to go see him. You know how it is with brothers." "And you want us to take care of the pigs," Matias said. "Well, yes," Mr. Gallagher answered. "It won't be too much trouble. Just get some slop and throw it at 'em. I'll be back in 2 days." And with that, he touched the brim of his hat and said, "Adios, amigas." "Amigas is for girls," said Cota. "What about us?" asked Matias. "Amigos, amigas, whatever," Mr. Gallagher replied and got in the truck and took off. My grandfather had been riding the tractor every day for a week without rest, trying to plant his watermelons, riding in the hard iron seat 8, 10, 12 hours a day. He felt a twinge at first, and then the pain hit him. He stopped the tractor in the middle of the row and cried out for us to go help him off. We carried him to the old Dodge truck, the one without doors, and took him home where he soaked his rear end in cool water. He came out of the bathroom, a towel wrapped around his waist, stooped, barely able to walk, and he looked at my grandmother and said, disgusted as he climbed into the bed, "It's the hemorrhoids. This time it's bad." He spent the next day in bed, watching us through the window screen as we played outside his room. During the night, he tossed in pain and was not able to sleep. He got up at 3 a.m, ran some water in the tub, and sat in it until daybreak. By then, he was so exhausted he was able to come to the bed and fall asleep. That night, I slept with my grandfather. He was resting more comfortably, but still in quite a bit of pain, when we were awakened by the scratching on the window screen. "Gonzalo!" I could hear the voice whisper. "What is it?" my grandfather asked. "It's me," I heard the voice say. It was Mr. Gallagher, on his way home from San Antonio. My grandfather was awake now and asked who it was. "Mr. Gallagher," came the reply from the dark. "What do you want?" my grandfather inquired. "Las Almoranas. ¿Cómo están?" he asked my grandfather. "The hemorrhoids, how are they?" The problem is communicating in two languages. It just so happens that the word in Spanish for hemorrhoids is almoranas. The word for sow is marrana. Two fairly close words. Mr. Gallagher thought he was asking about the sows when he was asking about hemorrhoids.
"Horrible,"
my grandfather replied in Spanish, fresh in the thought of his affliction.
"In lots of pain, more pain than I've ever seen in my life."
"Que pasa?" the surprised Mr. Gallagher asked in a panic, wondering what had happened to his sows.
"I don't know," my grandfather continued his tale of woe and pain. "It just happened. Lots of blood, pain, not able to walk, eat, horrible. I wish that death would come."
My grandfather could not see past the window screen. But Mr. Gallagher was holding on to the windowsill, trying not to collapse from the news. All his dearest sows were sick, in pain, bleeding, not eating, waiting for death. He was holding his head down, sobbing gently, so that my grandfather could not hear a grown man cry.
Vida! Muy duro! We heard Mr. Gallagher proclaim.
Dura! My grandfather corrected him immediately.
Dura! Duro! Whatever!
Mr. Gallagher answered through the stream of tears. And my grandfather, not to be outdone in the field of complaint, said in Spanish,
You never know what life brings. But there is no calamity which does not bring some good with it.
What are we to do? Mr. Gallagher cried out.
Wait, my grandfather replied. Wait and see if time will heal. What else can we do when God sends an affliction?
Later, we blamed my grandfather also. He should have known Mr. Gallagher was asking about his sows and not about my grandfather's hemorrhoids. It only stands to reason. How could Mr. Gallagher have known about the hemorrhoids? He had just driven into town. But then we had to consider, in my grandfather's defense, that a severe attack of hemorrhoids doesn't allow for much critical thinking. Mr. Gallagher gathered himself and said,
No, Moss, don't say no more. I'm ruined.
Leaving us in a state of confusion, walking away, crying.
And he left crying,
my astounded grandfather told my grandmother in the morning.
Crying?
My grandmother asked.
Over your hemorrhoids?
My grandfather got up and felt much better, but not before thinking of Mr. Gallagher and saying to my grandmother,
He must like us after all.
We were eating breakfast outside in the yard between the two houses early in the morning. Juan and Matias were sitting at one side of the table. Across from them were Cota, Maggie, and Francis. My brother and sister and I were across from our grandfather, who sat alone.
You see, children, he said, one must not judge a man by what he appears to be. Wait until you are ill, and then see who your friends are. Surely Mr. Gallagher has proven to be a friend. Who would have thought?
We were agreeing with him when we heard someone driving a truck at a great rate of speed, crashing gears, spinning its wheels. We looked toward the street and saw Mr. Gallagher's truck. It was him traveling as fast as the old truck would go. He came closer and closer until we felt he might not stop. Might want to run over all of us. In a desperate act, we ran to hide behind the salt cedars in the yard, looking for protection from a man gone mad. Finally, when we were sure he was going to run into the table out in the yard, he slammed on the brakes at the driveway and slid crosswise toward us, leaning the truck on its side before coming to a stop. Mr. Gallagher got off and, pointing a finger at my grandfather, began to say something. But in his anger, the only sounds we could hear were squeaks and grunts and moans. He tried several times, but he could not speak. We later knew he had come from visiting his sows. He calmed down a bit, and when he could open his mouth, he said,
Everyone off in my land. I don't want to see none of you on my land ever again.
He ran to the truck, got in, and took off in as big a hurry as he had arrived. We looked at each other and wondered what had gotten into the old man. My grandfather gathered us all, and we drove in the old Dodge truck without doors to Alice to inform Mr. Gallagher's wife that the old man had lost his senses. We found Mrs. Gallagher in the shade of a hackberry in the backyard shelling peas for dinner, a little black and white dog at her feet, waiting for a stray pea to fall its way. She took the news calmly.
We didn't know at the time that she was a hypochondriac when it came to Mr. Gallagher's health. She put down her bowl of peas and got up and walked slowly to the house. Looking back at us, she said, "I told him he'd either have a heart attack one of these days like his brother done, or go crazy someday, him and his hogs. You can't love a hog more than your wife and not go crazy." "Where are you going?" my grandfather asked her. "To telephone his son Hebert," she replied. "We'll go fetch him. He needs to be brung home and placed in a hospital, like I always predicted." When we all got back to San Diego, we found Mr. Gallagher in the pig pen on his knees, hugging his sows. His son Hebert got to him first, and being a big man, he picked up the confused and startled Mr. Gallagher like one would pick up a scarecrow, and forcibly threw him over the pen where his wife was waiting for them. She jumped on him, and between the two of them and us helping, ignoring his cries, we were able to tie him up and get him into the back seat of the car. And his wife and son drove off with him to take him to the hospital in Corpus Christi. The tragedy really put a burden on us. Now we had the sows to feed and take care of besides finishing planting our watermelons. But our grandfather said that we should count our blessings. How would we like to be insane like Mr. Gallagher? Well, we had seen what an insane man acts like, and we knew it wouldn't be any fun. He had been worse than Mercer. We'd rather plant watermelons. A day later, we see the dust from Mr. Gallagher's truck coming up the road. My grandfather told us not to talk to him, that he might be dangerous. We didn't have to say anything because Mr. Gallagher didn't say a word to us. He kept to himself. Whenever we'd go by in the old Dodge truck without the doors, we'd greet him, but he would look the other way, a scowl implanted permanently on his face. One night, I woke up with the bed shaking. I called to my grandfather, but he didn't answer. I turned on the light and saw him turning blue, his whole body trembling. I was in a panic. I ran to go get my grandmother and woke her up. Gota, Maggie, Francis, and Sylvia were sleeping with her. In the next room, Matias and Juan heard the noise and got up. We all ran back into his bedroom. My grandfather was sitting up, shaking, not able to breathe, having a laughing fit. In a state of lucidness, in between dreams, he had finally figured out what Mr. Gallagher was asking about that night, and he could not control himself. "Mr. Gallagher doesn't know the difference between hemorrhoids and sows," he was barely able to say between the laughter. "At 3 o'clock in the morning, you figure it out," my grandmother complained. The next day, my grandfather approached Mr. Gallagher cautiously and from a safe distance spoke to him and told him the difference. Mr. Gallagher thought a few moments as he continued to rub his favorite sow between the eyes and said, "Spanish is the hardest language there is to learn." The next year, still hurt from the incident, he let my grandfather have less acreage so that we couldn't plant watermelons. My grandfather, just to get even, planted gourds. And when Mr. Gallagher asked him what we were doing, my grandfather took a dried gourd we were using for seed and shook it at him. We started dancing to the rhythm of the gourd. My grandfather said, dancing, "We are going to get rich selling maracas for dancing. And don't confuse them with maranas." "I'll never understand Mexican talking," Mr. Gallagher said, walking away. This story comes from
I Can Hear the Cowbells Ring by Leonel G. Garcia. Author's Introduction. I was born and raised in San Diego, Texas, the county seat of Duval County. The long years of political turmoil have covered the little town like a black cloud. To those of you not familiar with its history, the town has a reputation for being bad. It was a county seat for political shenanigans dating back to the late 1800s. This is the courthouse where the infamous Box 13 from neighboring Jim Wells County was burned, making Lyndon Johnson a Texas senator. This is where the Parr family ruled politically for decades. This is where state officials sent four rangers to live, giving up on the old adage of one riot, one ranger. This is where state officials who came down to investigate after one election could not help but be amazed when they discovered that the people had all voted in alphabetical order. In my very early years, we were an inseparable collection of eight children brought together to gain the protection of the pack. Of course, we had a pecking order. I was the youngest and the least important. If any errand needed to be run, I ran it. If any disagreeable task needed to be performed, I was chosen. My brother Richard came after me, and then my sister Sylvia. They were above me, but not by much. Then came my grandmother's children, my uncles Juan and Matias, the two dominant males. Then came my aunts, Gota, Eloisa, Maggie, and Frances. Of the three aunts, Gota was the most dominant, and she fought often over leadership with her two brothers. The two branches of the family lived next door to each other, separated by an empty lot. We walked the hot, dusty streets barefoot, our pockets full of marbles, spinning tops, mesquite sticks, and balls, looking for a game to play. We were carefree then, getting up in the morning, leaving home after breakfast, and not returning until dark, all dirty and sweaty, hoping some supper had been left for us. As we crossed the yard by the light of the moon between my grandmother's house and ours, we could hear the voices of our elders sitting on the porch at my grandmother's, my grandmother fanning herself to shed the intense heat which had consumed her in the kitchen the whole day. By now, she had anointed her arms and neck with camphorated alcohol, and the vapors of the camphor reached us from afar. Under the stars and amid the sounds of the locusts, our elders made beautiful talk about people alive or long dead. Whenever there was disagreement as to a date, we would run to get Merced, our insane uncle, who knew exactly when each member of the family present and gone was born. Merced was an alcoholic, and most of the time we could find him drunk, asleep in the semi-darkness of his room, the lantern barely lit. Thrown on the bed, his clothes still on, snoring, the room reeking of tobacco and beer, he would have difficulty getting up. But he'd come. He loved company. If we didn't find him when we ran back home, our elders would say that Merced was at a tavern, putting on his show of madness in exchange for a bottle of beer. When Merced was young, he was sent to the insane asylum in San Antonio. There, in no time at all, according to my grandmother, he memorized most of the streets in the city. If in the course of a conversation he had a fit, they would just let him go running through the streets as though nothing had happened. "Be careful," my grandmother would tell him. "Don't run into anything in the dark." Merced would be gone, lost for the night. We would see him again the next morning, that is, if we didn't go sleep at his house. It was easy to laugh and cry in the dark with the stories.
We never knew who would be there for the evening. Relatives of all shapes and forms, both physical and mental, would come. Some would stay until my grandmother couldn't keep her eyes open, others just long enough to take advantage of a free meal. There was nothing quite so thrilling as to see a favorite storyteller approach. We knew we were in for a wonderful night of listening to tales of someone dying, dead, married, pregnant, jobless, toothless, penniless. The whole of the human condition was played before our eyes and ears daily. I never realized until later how much of life I had witnessed or been revealed to me during those years. Thank you for listening to Stories for Nighttime and Some for the Day. This is Doreen Salcy, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona.